Get in, losers. I'm Eric Vespi.
And I'm Anthony Bresnikan.
And we're watching It, Welcome to Derry, and we're talking about Season 1, Episode 2, The Thing in the Dark. But first, a word from our sponsor. Look at that. We're fancy now. We have a sponsor. It's not a cigarette commercial here, which would be really appropriate given the era that we're talking about. No, this episode of Watching It, Welcome to Derry is brought to you by Blackmagic Design, the makers of the cameras and post-production tools behind some of the most cinematic horror you've ever seen. And, I may add, one of the companies that helped create the It universe with Blackmagic's DaVinci Resolve, used for the post-production on both It and It Chapter 2. And Chainsaw Award winners and nominees, The Substance, Final Destination Bloodline, Screamboat Willie, Long Legs, and 28 Years Later, Hollywood level power without the Hollywood price. Learn more at blackmagicdesign.com. And now let's talk about some Stephen King shit, shall we?
Wait, I want to say something about the sponsor.
Please.
I like the title. I think it's a great name if they're going to be making... I know that the equipment is not just for horror movies, but if you're going to make horror movie cameras and video equipment, Blackmagic, that's some good branding.
Right? Yeah, no, I think that they know what they're doing over there.
That old Blackmagic that they weave so well.
Yeah, they need a theme song now. We gotta get on them. Tell them to provide a theme song to go in the background.
You do the read. I'll do the theme song, but I got to work on my pipes a little bit.
Yeah, you got to do your warm ups. Have your like honey and your tea and whatnot. Keep your your voice all relaxed. Before we dive into episode two, I want to talk a little bit about episode one. Like when we recorded the last one, people hadn't seen it. Like what have you been making of the reaction? Have you seen any reaction from the horror community and whatnot on the first one?
You know, I'm not that online anymore. So I honestly haven't, I don't really peruse like the boards or whatever. Or
right.
I'm not on Twitter. You know, I see stuff on Blue Sky and Threads. Which it tends to be the most reactionary stuff.
Right.
So, you know, my feeling is when people like something, they just go, oh, that was cool. Maybe there's some debate in like the Stephen King community. I think there's always, when there's an element of, let's say, fan fiction, where a filmmaker is adding, enhancing, or building around Stephen King's work, you know, there's always a lot of feistiness and debate about that. I just think it's so early in the process that most people are like, all right, cool. A lot of shock about the ending of episode one, where some of the characters who were set up essentially to be our new Losers Club do not make it past the first reel. I think, you know, Andy and Barbara Muschietti are giving us a Marion Crane moment from Psycho, where, you know, Hitchcock follows this woman. She's got the cash. She's making a run for it in the desert, and it turns out that there's nothing, that money is going to the bottom of the lagoon with her body. And this is actually the story of a bizarre psychopath who kills people in the shower and wears his mom's clothes. But
spoiler, that reversal, by the way, for a 60-plus-year-old movie.
Yeah, if you haven't gotten around to Psycho.
Or taken the Universal Tram Tour at any point in your life, yes.
You know, but when people first saw Psycho, they thought this is I'm following this woman, you know. It really broke with narrative tradition, and I think they pulled one of those. They pulled the rug out from under you here. I watched episode one early over the summer. I moderated a Comic-Con panel with Andy and Barbara, and so right away I had somewhere else I had to be after I watched the first episode, and they gave me the first two, and I had to at least start episode two, just because in the world of It and Pennywise, you never know for sure whether to believe your own eyes. So
right.
I'm like, is this just sort of a fucking crazy hallucination that everybody just had? Or did he really just tear those kids apart in a movie theater? Well, we got our answer with episode two. So I heard a lot of debate about that. But there's more. You're more plugged in to the chatter that's out there. So what did you see?
Unfortunately, I am, because listen, I don't want to be the doom scroller, the constant doom scroller, but you know, I am. I got my habits. I got my scrolling before bed habits now, and I can't seem to break them. For the most part, people seem to really dig that first episode. Like I was At least based on what I saw, and specifically because of what you were talking about, that rug pull moment. And that's the thing that like really impressed me when I saw it too, where I was just like, I love it when you can get kind of sucker punched in genre, because, you know, at this point we've seen it all, right? And so when you can have a little bit of a surprise, or your expectations can be completely upended, you know, I mean, M. Night Shyamalan made a whole career out of it, right? Like, it's really,
what a twist.
What a twist. It is really rare for that to actually work out. And I think that that it's such a great misdirect, because you had all the loser tropes there, right? So you're like, you instantly just go, yep, these are our new kids. And then you realize that this isn't quite the case. And I think that surprised people. Everybody I saw had a positive reaction to that. The only negative things I saw were, there were a few articles that kind of come up around the lampshade stuff, the Holocaust imagery, and people thinking that was a little insensitive. While I, you know, obviously, you know, would not diminish the real life atrocities that happened in the Holocaust, you know, I think that that's kind of what Pennywise does. He takes, you know, in whether it's in universe or like in the broad shared reality that we all live in, he takes the real life horrors and uses it against you know, the targets, the kids. And you know, I didn't find it super offensive, but I'm also not Jewish, so I don't know, you know, if that's you know, a common thread, or if it was just, you know, a few people that were like, you know, maybe that was a step too far, using, you know, real life atrocities in a kind of a goofy horror TV series. I feel like that there's, for horror to be effective, it needs to have a little bit of freedom to risk offending people. So I think that, you know, I don't feel like that, you know, Andy and Barbara and Jason Fuchs, one of the showrunners, I don't feel like they were there trying to be like, oh, you know, this is really gnarly and fun. Like, I think that they were using it specifically as a psychological torment, you know, for a, you know, a character who's been raised, you know, to revere and respect and you know, honor the horrors that their people have gone through. And, you know,
can you tell me where, like, where did you see these articles? Do you
I didn't write all that stuff down.
Social media reaction, or were these like, was it like an actual, the Anti-Defamation League had said something?
No, I don't think it's quite gone that far. I don't think it was that, you know, and listen, I'm not trying to make a mountain out of a molehill here. It's, you know, it was a very, you know, minor reaction, but it was something that made me kind of question just a second. Like, did I take that a little too glibly? 'Cause I thought it was a cool scene.
I think it's possible to go too far with that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not Jewish either, you know, I'm Roman Catholic, I guess, raised Roman Catholic. And I remember, starting about 25 years ago, there was a group called the Catholic League that would come out every time there was a movie that had an evil priest or like an exorcist type theme, which often involved the Catholic Church because it has these sort of Byzantine, literally Byzantine, like rules about exorcisms and things like that. And, you know, Kevin Smith's Dogma would invoke their ire. Any joke, any story, any fictionalization of Catholicism would invoke this group's rage, and they would write letters, and they were really sensitive to that. And okay, that's fine. I'm not going to tell anybody from any one group, especially a group I'm not a part of, whether to be offended or not. I think the question is whether the rest of us have to get engaged on that.
Right.
And I would say, yes, a horror film can go too far. A comedy can go too far. A romance can go too far in terms of, like, you know, making a story out of a real life occurrence that crosses a line. Right now, Oz Perkins is saying that true crime adaptations like the Ed Gein story that involves his father, Anthony Perkins, like that goes too far in fictionalizing my dad's life.
Right.
But I would, I know Andy and Barbara Muschietti, I know why they care about it and what it is about this story that engages them. I don't speak for them, but I would say, look, their intentions are good, but also good intentions don't mean that you can always walk the line, right? Sure. You can. The road to hell is paved with good intentions, as the saying goes. But in this case, I would say it's not just a cheesy horror flick. Like, you could look at something like, what was that movie about Nazis who went to live on the moon? Was it called Iron Cross? I remember this right.
Yeah, like, there's like the what was the, there was also like the frozen Nazi zombie movies and stuff. Yeah.
You know, there was that movie that J.J. Abrams produced a few years ago about right. Nazi vampires. Inglourious Bastards is a fictionalization right. of Nazis, and it's got avenging Jews in the bastards. You know, who are taking out Nazis. Is that insensitive? Wasn't there an Amazon show? Was it called Hunters? Is that right? That had Al Pacino in it. I should do my homework on this, but I'm just kind of reacting to the news. But there was an Amazon series about sort of 1970s era Nazi hunters that was sort of like very like funky, psychedelic, and sort of midnight movie-ish, you know, grindhouse style Nazi revenge story. And look, all of that, I'm sure, would be considered poor taste to somebody who, you know, lived through the experience or had a close relative who did. In this case, I would say it and Stephen King and the Muschietti's, as the adapters of this story, have honored the fact that Pennywise is a metaphorical representation of why human beings do evil. Like, I don't think Stephen King truly believes in shape-shifting, trans-dimensional entities that can cause hallucinations. I think he believes that societies can become distorted based on norms that they all begin to accept or look past, and that that is how true evil emerges, that there's an ugly impulse in human beings alongside a very good and generous impulse. And if it goes too far in one direction, you end up with bigotry. You end up with anti-black bigotry, which is a part of this story too. I think to not include anti-Semitism would actually be kind of a disservice, to pretend like that's not a part of this. You know, there's misogyny, there's child abuse, there's all sorts of horrible things. It's not yet been a part of Welcome to Derry, but in the novel It, the inciting incident, the violent act that serves as the sort of inaugural return of Pennywise in the 1980s is a gay bashing moment. Yeah. And that was based on a real incident that happened in Bangor that appalled Stephen King. And so I would look at this and say the scene in question is about a young Jewish boy born post-war, raised in America, who is hearing stories of what his people went through from his father. And his father, if you remember, is telling him, there's real horror in the world. Don't get wrapped up in these scary stories. Doesn't he throw like a comic book at him and say like, this is bullshit. Don't let yourself get sucked up into that. But comic books, horror stories, fiction, video games is how we confront our darker impulses. And so that lampshade scene, it is horrible, it is scary, but I don't think it's disrespectful, because that's what would play in the imagination of an American kid who is hearing stories of the Holocaust but doesn't have that firsthand knowledge. Right. He's disgusted. His stomach is turning. He is paralyzed by this fear. And so, you know, I'm not saying this does some great act of good, but I think it's also not necessarily worthy of condemnation, because it's manifesting something that is a real phenomenon, and that is how people who don't experience these things become aware of them and how that plays in their minds. So that's my take on it.
You just said that all that was everything that I was feeling about it, and you said it way better than I ever could. So I agree. You know, whether Pennywise is using the mummy or whatever, he's using the fears, the deep psychological fears of his victims against them. And in this case, we had that clear scene where the father, like you said, threw away the comic book and was just like, you don't need to be scared about any of this stuff. It's not real. You need to be scared of the real shit that happened. And, you know, and you can tell that wasn't the first time that conversations happened. So,
if I was in conversation with somebody who was offended by this, this would be my sort of, I guess, devil's advocacy.
But just right.
To say this is what it's about. One of my favorite movie reviews of all time is Roger Ebert's review of Raiders of the Lost Ark. And to me, this review is one I use as an example of how a critic can contextualize something. Like, we don't really need Roger to tell us thumbs up or thumbs down on something. Right. Like, we can make that decision ourselves. But a great critic also opens your eyes to something. And what he wrote about Raiders was, this is the fantasy of a young American boy who didn't fight World War II using his toys in the backyard to imagine how he would get revenge on the Nazis for what they did. And I think as time passes, you know, we're nearing almost a century from that horrible moment in history. The people who actually lived through it, even who were very young, are going to be gone. And stories and fiction and history is how we keep those stories alive. And I just think it's important for people to know the difference between fiction and the history. In this case, I don't think there's going to be any confusion. And I think the fiction is serving a purpose of showing how the trauma continues even with those people who never had to experience it. The notion that this could happen to you is pretty scary.
Agreed. Look at how deep we're getting. We're getting into some really deep material here. Well, you know, I am in total agreement with you. We can put episode one to rest. We got to talk about episode two, baby. We got to get into the new shit. And this is going to be airing right after people see it. So, you know, if you've got any questions or thoughts, well, maybe we do too, but we're going to talk through them here with you guys. So this episode starts with the end of the first episode, and it starts with in a different POV. We get different looks at some of the horrors that happened, which I love it when they do this in any kind of storytelling, whether it's movies, you know, the pulp fictionalized, you know, alternate POV kind of things. I love that stuff.
Yeah.
But you're seeing it here, and I think it's clearly establishing that Clara Stacks Lily is going to be one of the main characters here, because you're seeing all this from her point of view, and it is horrific. And I love that.
Lily is the girl who is, her father was killed in an industrial accident at the
and she had spent some time in a in Juniper Hill in the mental hospital because of her reaction to that. So she's already, you know, somebody who's ostracized at school. She's the weird kid. She's had a lot of personal trauma. It makes sense when you look at it now and you look at the kind of stereotypical loser personalities that were in the first episode, you go, oh no, of course the interesting character is Lily, right? It's got to be her. She's the main character, not the kid that's like the new Richie or whatever, right?
She's the most fragile. She's the most fearful.
And she's the one that has kind of the most to lose, as you find out through this episode. You know, where her experiences at Juniper Hill were, you know, seemingly almost more traumatizing than, you know, losing her father to an industrial accident, you know, at the pickle factory or whatever happened, you know. And so she's put into a position here where that's used against her by, I guess it's Henry Bowers' grandfather. It's definitely not his dad, right, who's the chief of police.
Yeah, that would be his grandfather, I believe.
His grandfather, who, by the way, you know, you're kind of shown him not as you would imagine a Bowers to be, right? He is not the guy that's just, I hate black people and I hate all minorities or whatever. He's actually fairly even keel, but it's the pressure of the townsmen and, you know, the constituency and the threat of losing his job that, like, kind of forces, where he's like, I have a little bit of a moral code, but also I care more about my own skin, so I'm going to pressure this poor girl into maybe not giving false testimony, but giving me enough room to, you know, arrest, you know, the black projectionist in this town that everybody wants to fall for this crime.
Well, I thought that was very subtle writing, because you know, Henry Bowers was a rabid dog, even as a boy. He's cutting an H into the belly of a chubby kid who's a lot younger than him. He ends up in Juniper Hill as a sort of Michael Myers type, right? Like, he just seems like... I forget why he ends up being sent... Well, it's the result of all the crazy stuff that happens with it. Yeah.
They also think he's the one that killed all the kids, too.
That's it. So he's sort of this... he's sort of this live wire, just a mad dog, essentially. And we see the abuse he gets from his father that creates him, but it doesn't really excuse. He's still a crazy rabid dog, right? So, and his father is a piece of shit who abuses a child to the point that he breaks them. The grandfather here, if it is the grandfather and not, say, great-grandfather, he's a little on the older side, but but I think he is the grandfather. Yeah. As the police chief, you would expect him to be the same sort of psychopath, right? Just sort of a relentless racist trying to pin this brutal murder, multiple child murders on the projectionist. But essentially, like, if you think about it, like, okay, these kids were murdered in the movie theater. Like, who had access to the movie theater? He would be a natural suspect. He's not looking for exonerating information on him for sure, but it reminded me a little bit of The Outsider. You remember, and how they follow the trail of evidence to this nice guy in the community that everybody seems to like, but the evidence is pointing them there. And so I felt like I didn't feel like he was pressuring her to give false witness, but rather he believed she's afraid to say what happened. And so I'm going to convince her through pressure to get over that fear. And I didn't feel that he is necessarily evil, and he's getting pressure from the townsfolk, you know.
I think he believes in his heart, though, that, like, this guy doesn't... He's like, he's got an alibi. He wouldn't be a suspect under any other circumstance other than the fact that we don't have, you know, we don't have somebody else. And he says as much to the townspeople. And I think he knows, by threatening her with a return to Juniper Hill, seeing her reaction to that and her just instant revulsion at the thought, and like, I can't go back, and she's a scared girl, just saying, I don't need you to say you saw him there. I just need you to say you don't know what you saw, so that opens the door, you know.
But what was the alibi? The alibi wasn't rock solid. It wasn't like, I was at a parade and 40,000 people saw me. It was like he was home with his mother, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's one of those things where...
The way that, like, he's playing it, though, you can see the policeman hunch where he's like, this isn't our guy, right? Just the look on his face when he's confronted with it. He's like, you know, he's like, the things don't add up here. But he, you know, it makes enough sense for him to protect his ass, you know, when it comes to his job and his standing in society and whatnot. So I think that there's a little bit of the Bowers, you know, selfishness and cruelty, where it's just like, I don't think that it's this guy, but also I don't care enough, you know, about a stranger to you know, put my neck out for him, which is kind of the, you know, exact opposite of some of the other characters, like Leroy, for instance, so.
That's what I appreciated about the writing, is that the Bowerses are not just insane psychos. They are this reminds me of that meme of the guy with the little domino and then the bigger domino and the book-sized domino and then, like, the monolith-sized domino where you see how something, the family starts to go askew. And I'm sure this leads to the abuse he gives to his own son, who then magnifies it and passes it on to Henry and makes somebody worse. Like, you see how the Bowers start to go off center. And yes, I think probably his own natural racism. This is a black man in the 1960s America that he suspects. So I doubt he's giving him the full benefit of the doubt. Right. There is an alibi. It's not 100% verifiable. Independently of this guy's own mother. So, you know, he has a choice, right? He has two paths. Give this guy benefit of the doubt or assume the worst, and he assumes the worst. And so that's the wrong choice, as we know, as the independent viewers. But also, maybe that's the influence of Pennywise. Maybe that's his own bigotry, his own prejudice, let's say. But yeah, he puts pressure on this poor girl who's already pretty shaken, and then they go shake this guy down. They go arrest him in grandiose fashion and make a spectacle of it.
Right. And that kind of brings in Amanda Christine's character, Ronnie, who's his daughter, who's one of the first people we meet in the show, by the way. She's, you know, she's the one that's trying to help out the poor kid that ends up with that horrible family in the cold
open. Yeah, the first victim. Kid. He's the one who kicks off this new cycle for Pennywise, I guess, for right? Sure. So,
And so it makes sense that she's there. And I, you know, probably my favorite part of this episode is the relationship that she has with Lily here, where they both kind of went through something together and they're both kind of depending on her. And then the betrayal that she feels whenever, you know, she believes that Lily, you know, ratted on her father or whatever and told the cops what they needed to arrest him, even though he didn't do anything. You know, it's something that I felt, and I, again, it's complex. This is a little layer of complexity that I think that you can explore in a long form show like this or in a novel. So this feels very novelistic. I would absolutely buy this being if Stephen King wrote like his own alternate things happening in the original novel or whatever, that this could be it. So
interesting symmetry here, because Lily lost her father in the pickle factory and Ronnie lost her mother in childbirth. And that leads us to one of the great gory shock scenes of episode two.
Which, by the way, there's two big scare scenes. If you're not counting the opening, which is, you know, kind of dovetailing on the shocking scene from the finale of the first episode, there's two scenes and they both involve parents, if you think about it. So you have the one that you're alluding to, which is it's pretty wonderfully executed, I gotta say, when she's in bed and Ronnie pulls the covers over her and then she can't get out and the covers turn flesh-like and
they
suddenly
become a little womb around her.
Right, and then she's literally birthed out by a monstrous version of her mother, which is, again, a very Pennywise-it thing to do, is to use that trauma, the thing that she actually fears, the fact that she killed her mother, and the shame and the guilt that she feels. You know, this is an entity that always does it. One of my favorite invented things that the Muschietti's have done is, even though I'm not a huge fan of how It Chapter 2 came together, I love the scene in the bleachers where Pennywise is talking to the little girl with the birthmark on her face and how he uses her own experiences. It's horrific. You know, how she's smart enough to go like, nah, I'm not in here with this. But then he manipulates her using her own guilt that she feels and her own shame that she feels about, oh, I look different and that's why people
don't like
me.
Yeah, she has the birthmark, right?
Right. She's got the birthmark on her face. And he uses that against her. And that's the... Or she, I should say. We've established, I think, before that Pennywise is actually female, if you're going to gender it in any way, shape, or form. But the way Pennywise works is that psychological torment. And, you know, this scene is horrific. It's horrifically executed. It is graphic as all get out. This is a scene you can get on HBO, you know. And the second birthing, within two episodes, you know, there's the birth of the mutant baby in the first one. And then she's birthed out of this thing, too. I don't know. Somebody's got to check in, you know, with the Muschietti's, I think, and see what birth trauma that they have in their past.
I know Andy has had a couple of kids. Like, he's the father of like two kids. I don't think I'm giving anything away. I think he's been public about that. But you know, I don't know anything about them. But when a kid is born and the dad is around, the dad is not part of that biological process after the initial conception, right? So you're just sort of like the assistant. And I can say, as the dad of two kids, look, childbirth, I'll let my wife speak for what it was for her own experience. But as the bystander, here's this person you love who's going through a physical trauma. Right. And if it's a C-section or it's a natural birth or whatever process it is hard on the body. And it's tough. It's tough, I think, for the mother who's not even really seeing it, but for the person who's standing nearby holding her hand, it's scary, you know? And I'm going to project that maybe Andy saw something he didn't want to see in that, in the room where the birth was taking place. And, you know, just the terror of Mother Nature probably made a mark on him. So, you know, but also, again, here's a kid who is growing up without actual memories of an experience. She doesn't remember being born. Nobody does. Right. But she knows that her mom died giving birth to her. Mm-hmm. And that's a real life thing. And that's a heartbreaking thing. And so you owe your life to somebody who gave it to you. It's an ultimate act of love. But I think in darker moments, late at night, in your bad dreams, you might do what Ronnie does and imagine yourself as a monster. And this being, you know, she imagines herself tearing her way out of the womb, and that's mm-hmm. how she escapes Pennywise. But is that what she did to her mother? You know, I think anybody who loves her, like her dad, would say that's not the case. It wasn't your fault. But do you accept that? And that's the question mark that Pennywise uses to dig deep into your guts, into your psyche, and generate and squeeze out that sweet, sweet fear that he loves so much.
Right? I mean, listen, it's why I think he's, you know, one of the ultimate fictional horror villains. Like, I just love that he can be anything to anyone. And the cruelty on display with each of his choices is, I mean, it's not delicious for the characters in the moment, but as a horror fan and as an appreciator of the text behind everything, you know, I find it very fascinating to see what either King himself or those adapting him choose to make Pennywise do, because, you know, I feel like leaning into the cruelty of this being is the secret sauce, and I think it's what the Muschietti's have done so well so far. And this is the ultimate act of it, and it's echoed with the scene with Lily later on in the grocery store, you know, where she actually, you know, her father was mauled to death, you know, in the jarring factory, in the canning factory, right? And they make, I think, one of the patty cakes or whatever in the first episode, or like making jokes about like seeing pieces of her, and the, you know, pieces of her father showed up in pickle jars later or whatever. And
then, well, they load up her locker with pickle jars that fall out when she opens it. So they're already doing the Lord's work if the Lord is Pennywise.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a symbiosis at play here, and why, right. You know, focusing on Derry, it's not like it Return of Pennywise, it's Welcome to Derry. And the fact that they feed off of each other, right? Mm-hmm. You have the real human cruelty, the bullying on display with the patty cakes, and watching that kind of personified with Marge, who is Lily's friend and is getting pulled into the cool girl clique, and trying to keep a foot in both. I want to be friends with my friend before, and trying to bring her into the patty cakes, right? You know, that's such a real thing. But like, they're doing all this real life cruelty, which kids are cruel. That's just a fact. Whether you were the cool kid or the picked on kid or somebody in between, you know how cruel kids can be. You could have been cruel. You probably were cruel yourself. That's just how it is when you're a kid, right? You lash out. You don't think about other people's feelings. And I like how that you know, that feeds directly into Pennywise. It's very it. That's very much what the book is. So you have this great scene in the grocery store, and both are, I mean, there's a sexual undertone to the reformed give daddy a kiss monstrous pickle man that kind of comes out for this girl that made me extremely uneasy, but obviously that was the point. And I think that there, you know, I don't get the feeling that Lily's dad was kind of the way Bev Marsh's dad was, where there was like this kind of hinting around of there being
molestation,
possibly molestation or borderline abuse in that form. I don't get the feeling that that's what happened with Lily's father, based on what I've heard. But you know, I again, it's just cruel for Pennywise to take this image. It's even, I think, almost worse if he was this, you know, idolized being in her mind, and then he's trying to transgress in this way. And obviously it's not like a real version of her dad. It's got like, you know, gut tentacles, and you know,
yeah, he's, like his face zombie is half sliding pickle off. It's like the pickle zombie version of her dad. So I don't think that's real. I think that's more just like, this is a gross thing, you know. and Pennywise is playing into that, but he is trying to, like, you know, like, he sticks his tongue out and he's like trying to, it's just, it's gross.
And, yeah, you see he sticks his like little gut and finger in her mouth and is like trying to hold her in place. It's gross. Yeah.
It's disgusting, but it's, I think again, this is just Pennywise going off the rails and going as deep and dark as possible. You know, it reminds me of like more like The Shining when Jack is kissing the beautiful woman and then he pulls back and she's an undead zombie. I like in the Kubrick film, it's just an older lady who's so it's like who's oh, middle swords. Age. Yeah. Yeah. So
wait a minute, you're not young and sexy anymore. I'm Jack Nicholson, damn it.
It reminds me of The Simpsons when they go through the horror house and there's just an old lady there and she's like, "Behold the ravages of age." So yeah, I think that was, you know, there's something about the pickleness of it too, like the vinegar, the decay, like, oh, the whole thing is very gross and very alarming. You know, yeah, they're two pretty good gross out psycho.
It's a well done.
What do you call it? Like
psychological
psychic
warfare?
Manipulation scenes. Right. Yeah, psychic warfare.
Yeah, the build up to it is really good too. I like taking that kind of Leave It to Beaver super clean grocery store with the happy announcements of what's on sale in which aisle and all that stuff, and how that starts to, you know, it's very reminiscent of the library scene right in the first It movie that the Muschietti's did. You know, where you're getting the suddenly in the background, people are looking at her and heads are like turning and smiling and deep, you know, in the bokeh, right, in the unfocused background. And suddenly, you know, it's all representing this feeling of being watched and followed. And, you know, for this character who's constantly worried about being viewed as crazy, you know, this the whole idea of the walls closing in on her, like all that stuff. I thought it was super well done. Mm-hmm. Plus, there's some good Easter eggs in there, but I have an Easter egg section. We'll get into here in a second. But so we've talked about the kids. Let's talk a little bit about the other side. We're talking about the adults, the Leroy Hanlon section here, because there's a pretty big bomb is dropped in this episode about you know, that I'm not 100% sure how much I like it, to be honest. So we're gonna, you know, I want to talk through this with you a little bit. So we kind of get a reveal of what exactly is going on in the army base. There's like that super hyper secret area that
Air Force. It's the Air Force, Eric. Careful.
Right. Sorry, it's the Air Force. Where, you know, we're
the army people will be like, we would never fuck with Pennywise. Like. Yeah.
It's like, no, we know what it is. We're, you know, but we get the answers as to why Dick.
That's those Air Force. That's those flyboys in the Air Force.
Yeah, no, they would mess around with this bullshit. We wouldn't.
The Marines. The Marines aren't fucking with the killer clown. You know, they don't roll with that.
Right. But we get the answers to why Dick Halloran's there. What that he's not. He just isn't just happened to be on base. He is there for a reason. The Air Force has pulled him in there for a reason. And we find out that it's because they kind of know that there's this possible weapon, supernatural weapon of some sort that strikes fear into anybody who sees it. And the Air Force is hunting, you know, this group, this U.S. government agency is hunting for Pennywise, essentially. And
Operation
using Dick Halloran,
Precept is the name.
Using
right?
Dick Halloran to sniff him out with his shining abilities, right?
Yeah, so. This is the first we hear Dick Halloran's name, too. We saw Chris Chalk as the character in the beginning, kind of eyeballing Jovan Adepo's Leroy Hanlon as he's first visiting the base. He's looking him up and down, like, and not in necessarily a friendly way. Like, not like the, hey, what's up, my man? Like, it's more like, he didn't trust this guy. Mm. And then we see him with his pals, you know, the other black airmen on the base, and they're looking for a place to drink and let loose and unwind. And, you know, they're doing it in the white establishment. They're not exactly welcome there. And I like when Dick Halloran, like, he just sort of nudges the other guys, like he's looking around the room. And I don't think you need The Shining necessarily to tell that maybe he goes like, it's time to go, boys, you know, like let's get out of here. Like, I don't think you need The Shining to maybe pick up on that, but it probably doesn't hurt to know these guys are pissed off. They're angry about this projectionist who they believe murdered these kids. Let's not be the ones who take the fall for that because we happen to look like him. So they, you know, they hustle out of there, and then they go to the base, and, you know, they're drunk as skunks, and, you know, the checkpoint guy isn't really going to feel good about letting them in, but Dick gets on the phone, and it turns out Dick Halloran has special privileges, and that's because, as you said, he is kind of like a metal detector for psychic energy, and they are using him to hunt down whatever this thing is. And I think it's interesting that the General Shaw doesn't know, played by James Remar, doesn't know what this is. He's not like, hey, there's this shape-shifting entity. It looks like a clown sometimes. He calls it a weapon.
Yep.
He doesn't know what it is. And this opens up a really interesting door, a controversial door for King fans, because nobody's supposed to know about Pennywise. Even the people in Derry aren't really aware that this thing is in the atmosphere around them.
Right, right.
The kids are, but when they leave town, they forget. And, you know, we got to make a few headlines with the King cast when Andy talked about adding a scene to the It movies that was ultimately deleted. But he gave us the story of that deleted scene of how why Pennywise makes people forget.
Right.
And how that, what their logical interpretation of that is. I think maybe he said they're never going to bring that thing back that he told us about, that scene.
Right.
So I think they're coming up with a different explanation. And I'm wondering, how can the U.S. military know about this? We are going to get the answer. I'll like tease that a little. I don't want to get too far ahead, but you and I have seen past this episode. And I will say it is a question that gets resolved in the next chapter. And in the next episode, rather. And but it is controversial about, you know, basically saying like, okay, this military organization knows about it. So is that what rubbed you the wrong way? Is that what chafed?
Well, on the surface, it felt like TV bullshit to me, right? It just feels more like something you'd see in a sci-fi channel thing where we're going to really explain, you know, and then we're bringing in the government, the U.S. government knows about Pennywise or knows enough to be bringing people in and targeting it, you know what I mean? So it obviously had to be a question that is answered even more broadly than I think they resolve it in the next episode you know, of how they're going to, you know, not make this just a thing where like, oh, and then they pack it away like the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark and just let shit still happen, you know, in this town, right?
Yeah.
So, and I also, I gotta say, I liked the more happenstance version of Dick Halloran being there. And you know, funnily enough, I saw an red carpet interview, I think for maybe during one of the premieres or whatever that Dick, that Chris Chalk was at, who plays Dick Halloran. And he was talking about you know, his feelings on playing the character in this scenario, and how it's kind of fascinating for him to, you know, to play this guy who has had this kind of supernatural power, but this isn't something that is common. You know, he in the The Shining, he mentions having, you know, the link with his grandmother or whatever, but it's not like he's out there running into people with the shine every day. You know, he's used to being the one always with this extra edge. And what happens to that character when he just happens to be in Derry, Maine during one of the non-slumbering cycles of this entity? And does that humble this character when he goes up against something that, you know, that suddenly he doesn't have the edge about, you know, him anymore? And I'm like, that to me is so much more interesting than like, oh, he's brought in to sniff out relics and stuff, versus he just happened to be there and he's kind of got the cock of the walk, you know, the power of youth, you know, and feeling like he's invincible and he's got this thing. And what happens when he runs into like this real horror, you know, which he'll eventually end up working around, you know, later on in his life. And to me, the happenstance of it is more interesting than he's there for a reason and he's purposefully poking at the bear. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean, you're right. Dick Halloran is a character who at this point in his life is used to holding all the cards, you know,
yeah.
He has this shining ability that his grandmother had, and that kind of made a special bond between them. And I think we're going to see a little more about that going forward too. And this is, again, the grandma is another character from The Shining, kind of an indirect character, but she's the one who gives that ability its name. She calls it The Shine, you know? And I felt the same initial uneasiness with this storyline that you did. It felt like it was dragging Pennywise and it into the light.
100%, yeah.
Do you know what I'm talking about? Yep. Like, and this is, that's not supposed to happen. Like, well, okay, well, now will there be a story in the New York Times about, like, this town where, like, but that's not happening. Right. And what I found as the story progressed, and again, I don't want to go too far into future episodes, but that unease has been mitigated for me, and I'm kind of rolling with it. And now that I've rewatched this episode two, I'm like, okay, I still get why it bugged me at first, but I started to think of other stories like this. And the interesting thing about Welcome to Derry is that Andy and Barbara and their writing team are really pushing the boundaries of what Pennywise is. They are poking at the edges of this themselves. And if I could add a little self plug here, I did a story for Esquire about this phenomenon, about expanding the lore of Pennywise, is that they've taken Stephen King's story and all of the detail he put into it, explaining his own rules and logic and kind of feeling around the history of the character. And this isn't just about how did Pennywise come to be? How did he come to be here? It's what are the rules of this thing? Like, how does it work? What is it? And Andy said he was asking Steve himself this when he visited the set of It Chapter 2 and shot his cameo scene as the thrift store clerk. And he was asking him so many questions about the turtle and about Pennywise and what the rules are here and what the rules are there that Steve finally had to say, look, I don't know. Like, I wrote this a long time ago. I don't know myself. Like, I don't know the answer to that. And so I don't know that Andy in this show is going to provide the answer, but they're poking around the edge. And so the reason this military thing started to work for me was I thought of, you mentioned Raiders of the Lost Ark. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, Hitler wanted artifacts of the occult in that story to, you know, help him win the war. And the Americans wanted these artifacts too, if they existed. And so these would be black ops, black ops, that's a redundancy, but it's sort of a black ops operation within the military. It's not necessarily something you announce. It's like a small division. In a way, like the X-Files, right? You remember how, like, Mulder is down in the basement and down there with, like, the hot water heater and his weird files. So it had Raiders vibes for me. It has X-Files vibes of, okay, what if the FBI... Like, I could see Mulder and Scully being sent into Derry to, like, figure out what's going on there and then coming away without really a lot of answers, but a sense that something's there. And so the military, knowing that something is up, has started to, like, okay, that's starting to work for me. Yes, of course they would find out something at some point. How they find out why the memory doesn't fade and how far that extends into sort of mainstream military leadership, I think is a question that's answered by it's not. This is like a fringe group out here in Derry, poking around, digging in the woods, using this guy Dick Halloran in an off the books way. A lot of it seems off the books, even beating up Leroy Hanlon to see if he really is a man without fear.
Right.
That's not like a sanction. That's a code red, you know what I mean? From a Few Good Men. Like, that's not something you get, like, permission and go through proper channels for. So this is a rogue. I feel like this is a somewhat rogue operation.
Okay.
And there's another book called Hex by Thomas Olde Huvelt, which is one I know a friend of the show, Mike Flanagan, really, really enjoys. And that's about this witchy presence in a small New England town who sometimes just appears on the street with these sewn-up eyes and sewn-up mouth. She's terrifying, and people in the town are kind of cursed by her. But as long as they don't mess with her, they're okay. And there is, like, an element that Huvelt puts into the story where the government has known about this witch since, like, the Civil War era, since this town was built up. And they maintain a kind of little watch post. So that's where you get like the modernism and the technology fused with like the archaic and the mythical. And I think that's what we're getting here with Pennywise and the military, is you have the bright lights of society and mainstream culture stepping forth to challenge this thing that exists in the shadows. But I don't feel they fully yanked him out into the light. And the resolution, the little cliffhanger at the end when they find the Model T in the mud, I thought was actually a pretty cool way of connecting the past to this present, the 1960s to the 1930s, where we know there's a sort of Bonnie and Clyde gang called the Bradley Gang who get shot up on the streets of Derry. And that's going to be season two of this series. So right now they're flashing forward a little bit themselves.
Right, yeah.
Anyway, that's my reason why it's kind of working for me. All those different examples, like, okay, it's kind of like this, kind of like that. We'll see where it goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, listen, it's something that I'm not dead set against, but it was a warning flag. I've seen I've seen too many series that I really started with and enjoying, and then they start introducing all these extra complications for no reason, and I'm just like, you're muddying the waters a little bit when it comes to something that's fairly straightforward, and sometimes that turns into brilliant, you know, reveals, and sometimes that just, you know, ultimately just drowns my enthusiasm for a show. So that's why it was a warning, you know, it was a red flag versus a, man, I really hate this, you know. It's more of we'll see how it goes.
King does this in his stories. You know, I remember it's like a throwaway line in Pet Sematary where you know, Judd Crandall is leading Lewis Creed through the woods to this weird burial ground, and Lewis is like on top of this shaved down mountain and these strange little cairns and symbols of made out of rocks, and he's like, what does this look like from the air? Has anybody ever seen this? Like, and I think like that's just the writer going, yeah, okay, how is this, how does this remain secret?
Right.
And it's not really answered, but I just think it's a good way of scratching that itch in the reader.
Right.
And so just to ask the question, and I think the question here is, what if people did find out about this? And there's another answer to that hidden within this episode. Not exactly hidden, but the connection isn't explicit. But we see Native American people from Maine kind of checking out where these military folks are digging. And it's implied that they have knowledge of Pennywise.
Yeah.
And I think that's something not explored in King's book that's really interesting, is if this character, Pennywise, if this shape-shifting entity is as old as time, well, then the first humans to live on this land would also have had encounters with it.
For sure.
And, you know, Andy, in my article for Esquire, said one of his questions was, why does Pennywise stay in Derry? And I think we're feeling around the edges of that, and he's coming up with his own answer. And I think the Native American people are, you know, they're clearly like, I don't think they fully understand what this thing is, but they know enough to not fuck with it.
Right.
And, they know their legends, they know their oral tradition and their stories. But, okay, so they knew about it. And then the white settlers, the European settlers, come to Derry and build Derry and start their logging operation. And they start to find out about it. So I think, like, secrets get out. The burial ground in the woods at Pet Sematary wills itself the secret to be revealed. And I think that's what we're seeing is, okay, these people know about it. Now these people know about it. Now the military knows about it. Where does it go from here?
Right.
I like that question. So I'm kind of down to see where they go with it.
It's definitely interesting. Well, you know, I think my ultimate enjoyment of this series is going to depend largely on how they resolve that plot thread. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. You know, we've seen a little bit in advance, but we haven't seen the full run of the series, so I don't know.
Something tells me this is not going to end with Pennywise being deputized into the FBI.
Pennywise is Richard Nixon. You heard it here first.
Agent Pennywise.
So you mentioned the Bradley Gang Model T that Dick Halloran helps them find. That is one big major Easter egg. That's more than an Easter egg. It's going to be a major plot point. As you said, we're going to be getting at some point a full story behind the Bradley gang, which is one of the more interesting parts of the book to me in terms of the backstory, because it shows once again the complicity. And I barely said that word correctly. Of the
complicity,
town,
I think, is what you meant. Yeah.
Of the town. You know, I don't want to. Well, listen, if you've read the book, you know what happens to the Bradley gang. Mm-hmm. If you don't, I think it could be a really shocking moment when you realize that it's not just Pennywise fucking with, you know, with random people, but his evil influence, you know, bringing out the worst in the townspeople, which is really interesting. So I'm going to still use this as an excuse to jump into Easter eggs, even though it's more of a plot point than an Easter egg. I wanted to see what you caught and what, because I'm sure I missed a few things, but I caught a few things on this watch. Obviously, you mentioned the Stephen King character from the It Chapter 2. Did you catch that you get to see a young version of that character in this episode?
Well, I was going to ask whether you thought that was him or not. So we go to Secondhand Rose,
yeah,
which is from the book. That's where Bill Denbrough buys his bicycle, uh-huh. His bicycle Silver, right? Wasn't that the name of it?
Yeah. I owe Silver away for sure.
So we meet Secondhand Rose herself. She's a Native American woman who's running the shop. The shop looks really good in this series. When we see it in It Chapter 2, it's more of a junk shop than a thrift store. Mm-hmm. At that point, but it still has the license plates up on the wall. I think in It Chapter 2, one of the license plates is Christine's license plate.
For sure.
Yeah. And Stephen King himself is the proprietor. And Andy had always planned to, he wanted to do a flashback to when the kids are young, because you guys will remember in It Chapter 2, we still see the kids now and then, we still get some flashbacks. He was going to show them going to the shop as kids, and Joe Hill was supposed to play the Stephen King shopkeeper, which I think would have been really cool, but they didn't do that. I don't know if they even shot that, but I think that was Andy's initial idea.
Yeah.
And so in this episode, we see Secondhand Rose herself talking to like her little shop assistant, who's like a kind of tall, thin beanpole of a guy with my kind of black rimmed glasses. Is that supposed to be the Stephen King guy?
I'm 100% sure that's the intention, because he's reading off stuff and listing things alphabetically like he does, you know, as the joke in It Chapter 2, where he's like
trying to
you know, he's doing the stuttering Bill's trying to get out what he's saying, and he's like, baseball card, this, blah, blah, you know, he's just keeps doing B things, but he's reading off a list, and he's like, baseball card, blah, 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 he's doing the same thing. And if you've ever seen a picture of Stephen King in like high school, like,
oh yeah,
he's got the black, thick horn rim glass, not quite horn rim, but yeah, the thick frame glasses. He's wearing the white shirt. He looks exactly like that character. So I'm 100% convinced that's supposed to be.
I thought so too. Yeah. I'm like, yeah, that seems to track.
I also we meet the butcher named Kirsch. Mm-hmm. And if you remember, Kirsch is the name on the door whenever Bev is looking for. To visit her father, the adult Bev is going back trying to see if her father's alive, and it's Mrs. Kirsch that is there. I'm wondering if that just could be a coincidence, because I know in the It Chapter 2 specifically, like, they use Mrs. Kirsch as like a potential maybe offspring of Pennywise, because she keeps talking about her father, you know, and all the pictures of her and her dad, and it's the Bob Gray version of Pennywise and all that stuff. I don't know.
Yeah, that, I think there's a lot in that scene in It Chapter 2, I think, that will go over the heads of people who aren't steeped in the lore of Pennywise.
Right.
Like, what is she talking about? Why are there these pictures on the wall that sort of look like Pennywise? Like, I think it's like a man who's clearly Bill Skarsgård, but balding, middle-aged version of him. And then a little kid beside him who looks like Henry Bowers' dad, right? So it's a little strange. And again, it's like, is this part of the hallucination? But Mrs. Kirsch, she was from the book. That scene is directly from the book.
Yep.
Bev comes back to her old apartment, and Mrs. Kirsch is living there. And at first, she seemed like a sweet old lady with tea and crumpets. And then she metamorphoses into a terrifying crone.
Yeah.
And the question I always had, which I don't think is fully answered, is, was Mrs. Kirsch real? Was that a real person who just took the form of this crone? The use of the name Kirsch for the butcher makes me think, okay, well, there are Kirsches in this town, and and generations of we see the Bowerses, we see the Hanlons, we see the Uris family. That's the Jewish family of the boy who was murdered. That's the big brother is going to be Stan's father. From the classic Losers Prime group. And so, you know, I think that we're going to get a little more explanation about Mrs. Kirsch and the Kirsch family if this butcher becomes a more prominent figure. Right now, it's just who Taylor Page, her character, Leroy Hanlon's wife, visits. And he is very gentlemanly to her.
He is. He's very kind. He's very the antithesis of what you would think.
He doesn't show hints of the racism that you would expect. He's not like, you're not welcome in my shop. He's very supportive, but I wonder, like, is that the veneer or is that the reality?
I don't know.
I think we'll find out.
I don't know, because he does have that moment whenever she sees the bullying happening, and he's just like, boys will be boys, you know, which is very much, you know, I think there's good people that live in Derry, but I think that they have that that thing of looking the other way, even, you know, even the good people. I don't think, obviously, Derry isn't just made up of monsters, but it's, I was pleasantly surprised that, because he has that moment where he's just like, you passing through, or he's like, I just moved here, you got a problem with that kind of thing? He's like,
She's ready. She's like braced for the prejudice.
Yeah, I didn't. He's like, I didn't mean it like that. You know, I'm, you know, he's like, I'm, he says something very specific about like varieties and spice of life, or, you know, something like that.
Some of my best friends are.
It's just like, I like new faces or whatever. He's very kind.
He would have voted for Obama for a third term.
Third term. Yeah, absolutely. You know, but it's not that overt, you know, the easy racism that, you know, sometimes King himself falls into, right? Where it's just easily, like, this guy, he paints in a broad stroke, like, this guy, racist, this guy hates gay people, this person, you know, really hates Hispanics or something, you know, it's real easy to do that, where I think a lot of prejudice is more nuanced than that. So could there be prejudice there? I'm sure there is, but I do like that he was cordial and kind, and it didn't feel fake to me, but he still had that little moment.
Seemed like a good guy, right?
Seemed like a good guy, but he still had that moment where he's just like, that group of bullies is picking on a poor kid. Boys will be boys. That happens. You know, again, that happens in real life too. So the other major Easter egg that I saw on this one is in the grocery store scene, where I don't know if you noticed this, but there are whole rows there of cans of Calumet baking powder.
Yeah,
and
that's.
Are you familiar with that? That these are the ones that are the big cans that have the Indian head logo, which Kubrick very famously showcased in the pantry scene in The Shining, which then spawned a whole bunch of conspiracy theories about, you know, what does all the, you know, native imagery mean within The Shining and all this stuff. And see, he's definitely doubling down on it because there are these, you know, Calumet baking powder cans in there.
Room 234 did a number on that, I think, right? That movie.
So, I
that's the scene where Jack ends up in the pantry. You know, Wendy, you hurt my head real bad.
Real bad. Right.
But yeah, those are in the background, so those are plugged in there. We're going to skip a little ahead in time, but I was kind of hoping that we would see Fun Twinks cereal in the grocery store. Fun Twinks is a little Easter egg in The Running Man, the new movie that Edgar Wright directed coming up. And can we tease this a little bit?
Why not?
You know, we've got an episode coming up about that movie, an interview with Edgar Wright. And on the KingCast channel. In the book, The Running Man, Richard Bachman, Steve's, pseudonym, his nom de plume, mentions this futuristic serial called Fun Twinks, and we were laughing about that, and Edgar thought it was hilarious too, so he had to put it in the movie. But I don't think it meant in 1972 when Steve wrote it. I don't think that term meant what it means today, certainly not as prominently, but that's kind of a funny Easter egg. It's not in It, Welcome to Derry, but I kind of wish it was.
Yeah, there's a serial gag that happens in the sequence that, but it's the poor little kid from the opening of the first episode popping up on the cover of the Wheaties or whatever, right?
Yeah.
But yeah, I wanted to ask you one other thing from this section, though, and it's, you see it a little bit earlier whenever Lily's being interrogated and she's like nervously pulling the peel off of the soda bottle. But Fizzola is the name of the soda there, and you see it pretty prominently in the the grocery store scene. And I was trying to rack my brain, like it definitely reminds me a little bit of Nozola, which is the Dark Tower soda, right? That's the alternate universe version of Coca-Cola, essentially, in the Dark Tower.
Yeah.
Or Pepsi-Cola, maybe, because King likes Pepsi.
King loves his Pepsis.
He loves his Pepsis for some reason. He's the
choice of a new generation.
It's like him and like seven other people are the reason why we have to put up with fucking Pepsis at restaurants. Thanks, Steve. but I was wondering if Fizzola was something from the books. Does that ring a bell to you? Like, I didn't bother looking it up. I probably should have, but, do you think it was made for this?
I think I remember the Nozola thing. So maybe it's a connection to that.
Yeah. I was wondering,
cereal from Cujo? King has a thing about cereals and things like that. What was the, nope, nothing wrong here.
That made all the kid shit blood that, so everybody thought, but it was just,
yeah, it was like a cereal with red dye that ended up like causing kids would throw up and parents thought that their children were like dying from internal bleeding, and it was just the red number 5 dye in the cereal. Nope, nothing wrong here was the catchphrase for that cereal. But I love that that use of the repetitive catchphrase that turns up throughout Cujo. So, you know, I would have liked to have seen that on the shelves too, but you know, maybe that's just what there's only so much Easter egg goodness you can stuff into an episode.
Red raspberry zingers?
Yeah.
Is that, I don't know. Sharp cereal? I don't know. I was doing a look. Yeah, sharp cereal, Twinkles, Sharps. Cocoa Bears, and Brand 16.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think King, Steve must be grossed out by kids' cereals, and that's why he comes up with like Fun Twinks and this sort of blood red cereal dye and things like that. He must just look at tricks and just like his stomach turns.
It's that and corn. Like King hates corn or loves corn because the corn pops up everywhere. So there's no corn so far in It Welcome to Dairy, but I wouldn't put it past him for corn to make an appearance just as a nod to Steve's constant usage of corn in his books in the movies based on them. But yeah, is there any other final thoughts that you want to see? Were there any Easter eggs that I missed that you saw?
I think you caught them all. I don't think it's a show that does a lot of that winking, which I think is a good thing. It kind of bugs me sometimes when, like, a 1958 Plymouth Fury just happens to be on the street in a Stephen King adaptation. Like, I know it's Christine and all that, but like,
fuck you, Life of Chuck.
Yeah, I don't know that they need... That's a little too on the nose sometimes, and it's been done, so, you know. Or like in Cat's Eye, they show... Not only do they show Christine, but they put a bumper sticker that says like, I am Christine on it. And
it almost hits the Cujo dog, right?
And like then there's breaks. A Cujo dog, right? Yeah. Like, it's like, oh, okay. Yeah. It's a hat on a hat on a hat, and then...
And I think that dog was the dog from Cujo, if I'm not mistaken.
Was it really?
So, yeah.
So, wonder if he's still around. We should get him on the King Cast.
Well, the guy that was in the dog suit for some of it's probably still around. I don't know if you've ever seen that, but listening, if you don't know what we're talking about, look up behind the scenes images from the making of Cujo, and you're going to see a dude in a head to tail, literal tail, dog costume doing like a conga line with Dee
Wallace. Is he the same guy in the dog costume in The Shining or whatever that is? Is it a dog?
That's a different kind of dog costume, my friend. The blowjob dog and Cujo are not related. Thank you very much.
All right. I think that kind of hits it all. I'm ready for episode 3, man. It's a great Chris Chalk episode, like a really good Dick Halloran episode. And if I can do a little plug, I've got an interview with him coming up on Esquire 2 that'll sort of dive into the secrets of Dick Halloran. So I hope people will check that out too. That'll drop after episode 3, but we'll tease that next episode of Watching It.
Great. Well, we'll see you then for episode 3. Happy Halloween, everybody.
Happy Halloween.